Hi, I'm Sophie, and this is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter, a space where, together with my producer Fee, I talk to good friends and trusted experts on how they age well, whether it's their latest supplement stack, what's on their bathroom shelf, or a new biohacking device that really seems to work. Because for me, aging well is all about looking and feeling like the best possible version of ourselves, both inside as well as out. Remember, you can also find even more ideas and expert tips on my social channels at Dr. Sophie Schotter. I'd love you to come and join me over there too. So this is my show. Welcome along. As always, thank you so much for listening. And this week, Fee and I are in conversation with Mr. Mark Pacifico. Mark, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. You're not only one of the UK's most experienced and respected plastic surgeons, but you also have just handed over the presidency of BARPS, having been president for 2 years. And of course, that's a huge testament to not only your work, but also your ethos. So for anyone who doesn't know what BARPS is the British Association of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons. So thank you for joining us. And last summer, the singer Robbie Williams talked really openly about plastic surgery and said that everyone sees the so-called bad surgery and the good procedures go unrecognised. He also went on to say that most people in the entertainment industry have had really good plastic surgery that has simply gone unnoticed. How much do you agree with this? And if Robbie is right, could you offer a really simple to understand explainer on how facelifts have changed over the years? Perhaps old technique versus new.
Hi, Sophie. That's a great way to start. And I think it's really refreshing to hear what Robbie said. And I think he's absolutely right. And I've been in countless social situations knowing that certain people there have either been my patients or have had work done, only to hear from someone else, oh, you can really tell who's had plastic surgery. It's so obvious when they are not aware of the person sitting right next to them who's had really good work done. So I think he's absolutely right. And I see that time and time again. And I think the rule of thumb that we really recognize these days is what you get out of a procedure very much depends on what you put in. And by that, what I mean is the attractive sounding procedures, the mini this, mini that, are often ones that don't leave people looking natural and leave certain stigmata of having had something done and maybe leave people looking a bit strange. Whereas if you have a more comprehensive procedure with modern face lifting and other facial surgical techniques, then actually you're going to have a result that looks better, looks more natural, looks like you, and inevitably lasts longer.
Hi, Mark. We do want to get into modern day technique and protocols, which I think you're touching on there. Thank you for that. But firstly, how would you describe a typical patient, not only age and gender, but also what sort of things do you hear in terms of people's reasons and motivations and their fears and worries too? What would we hear if we were a fly in the wall pre-op and I guess the same post-op once things have settled down?
That's a great question. And I think there is no absolutely typical patient, but one observation over the last, let's say, 10 or so years is that I think the average age of the facelift patient is getting younger. And I think there was a time when most people having facelifts were in their late 50s to 70s. And now I think that perimenopausal time period of life is becoming a real peak at when people are considering surgery, because those hormonal changes on the face, the facial architecture, the support really are starting to have an impact. And there's a more of a recognition that when done well and executed properly, a good face and neck lift can produce outstandingly natural and inconspicuous scars with natural result. The typical patient is, for me, is a woman in her late 40s to mid 50s, perhaps a little bit older. And what I hear is comments that relate very much, in summary, that result in confidence, self-esteem, feelings of invisibility, a gradual reduction in presence and a sense of self.
That so rings very true with the types of patients I generally see as well, whether they end up going down the surgical or the non-surgical route. I think that rings very, very true with the demographic I see as well, which is why I also send and refer many patients over to you.
There was a patient of mine I saw last week and she summed it up brilliantly. She literally said that prior to surgery, when she went to get a drink at the bar, she stood there for ages and was inevitably the last person to get served, being looked over and passed over by the barman time and time again. Yet since her surgery, she exudes confidence and is the first person to get served. And she said she now feels visible, she feels seen. And it was an interesting conversation. I asked her, I said, is this because of how you look or how you're feeling about how you look, or perhaps a bit of both?
Yeah.
And I think it was the latter. It was a bit of both. It was that confidence, that self-esteem, that feeling that she's got her old self back again, that exuded that positivity as well as looking great.
Mark, as you've previously said to my team when we were setting up this chat, the internet has changed everything in that there's now so much more knowledge out there for people to access, some good, some not so good. And you were saying that this certainly comes across in the consultation, in that people can be quite prescriptive about what it is that they want you to do or what they feel they should be having. And certainly, again, that's something I've experienced an awful lot in clinic. How do you feel about this? And can you talk a little bit more about your initial consultations, including what you're looking for when you're assessing people's faces and their suitability for surgery?
It's very interesting. And I think Instagram in particular has really changed everything. And the reality, if as clinicians, both surgeons and non-surgeons, if we're okay, to be honest about things, is we're rarely posting results that we don't feel are good results. So we are skewing the dial in favor of the better outcomes from procedures, which is therefore raising possible expectations from potential patients. And of course, it's internationally accessible. So there is no geographical boundary. So people can see the results surgeons are getting in any part of the world. So I think this is raising the bar. There is a lot of information out there, but what is hard for patients to ascertain, they are not the experts in the field, is what is and isn't relevant to them or appropriate for them. So as you say, someone may come in with almost like a commodity. I would like this, this, and this. And it's like, hang on a second. You're coming to consult with me. I'm the doctor. I'm the expert. If you tell me what your problem is, let me examine you, come up with the diagnoses and then the treatment plan and solutions to your problems. Tell me what you're concerned with, how you're feeling, you're looking, what your goals would be. And actually, that's quite interesting because I try and get the patients not to be very focused and specific on a goal, saying, I would like this band to go, or I would like this a little bit higher. I'm saying, just tell me the big picture, a bit like we talked about before. What stimulated you in coming here? Is it a lack of confidence? Is it because you are feeling, a typical comment, it's your mother looking back at you in the mirror now and it's really making you feel very low? What is it in general? Because keeping that big picture is so very important, because we're all critical about ourselves. And if someone overanalyzes and is overcritical, there is never a point that they'd be satisfied and happy. And keeping that big picture and understanding globally what it is we're trying to achieve, I find a much better way of strategizing with my patients as a team together.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you and Sophie have in common is not being afraid to turn people away if you're unsure of their expectations or even their mental health. Can you expand on that a little bit more? So, for example, have you turned many people away, or have you ever had somebody really quite young who wanted a facelift and you went, no?
Absolutely. I turn people away week in, week out. And it's for a whole variety of reasons. It could be because of my concerns about their psychological perspective, or maybe what they're coming to see me for. I've had countless patients over the years saying they think their facelift, in this example, will save their marriage. And I said, it really won't save your marriage. If your marriage is in that position, you need that addressed before you come and see me. And the danger is, if surgeons, in this case, operate on someone and they are hoping that whatever the surgery is going to fix a relationship problem, which of course it won't. When that relationship problem persists after the surgery, they turn their sights on the surgeon and saying, it's your fault, my relationship's in trouble. And I've had that. And I know every colleague who's been around for a while will have had experiences like that. So there are many reasons that I turn away people. I mean, you asked about age. Age is quite an interesting one, because it is not a prescriptive cutoff to say below a certain age, one should not have a certain procedure. So for example, when it comes to neck lifts, I have a number of young patients in their 30s who have developed through just their genes and hereditary reasons or for other reasons, very full necks and double chins that are totally out of keeping with their fat distribution on the rest of their body and elsewhere. And that's because of an anatomical variation. And therefore, there are some reasons to do certain facial procedures that are addressing contours that really are out of keeping with the rest of their facial structures. So it's not a no, but it's really understanding the suitability of that individual. And that's what it's about. It's tailoring everything for the individual.
The before and after shots on your website and social media, not that you post lots of befores and afters in the way some people do, but they're seriously impressive. And I obviously know along the way many of your patients and their results have been equally impressive. And I think the key thing that stands out across all of them that I've seen is that they all look so natural. Would now be a good time to talk more about deep plane as a technique for facelifting? And what can you tell us about this particular approach?
Yeah, so deep plane really has become a very well-known concept over the last few years, but it's actually first described 34 years ago. So the term deep plane was coined by a fantastic American surgeon called Sam Hammerer, and it's been developed and modified ever since. And really, there was a surgeon from New York, Andrew Giacono, who brought it through social media and other media outlets to the forefront of everyone's non-surgical minds. So the deep plane approach is a way of achieving a very natural result with a facelift, because it is lifting the sagging structures of the face at the most fundamental level, which is not under the skin, but it's under the further layer that's beneath that, which is referred to by the acronym, the SMERS, the superficial musculoepineurotic system, which I always describe as a soft tissue skeleton of the face, which is what sags, and our skin is like a passenger that's stuck onto the SMERS. So it looks like our skin sagging, but it's actually just our skin's being dragged down by the SMERS. So in a deep plane, which is a more technically challenging approach for facelifts, so not every surgeon will do that, it allows that SMERS layer to be freed up from all its connections, which are deeper down, and then lifted with very little tension, which is what we really want in any surgery anywhere on the body, to look natural. And that can be relocated to where it used to be. And then the skin comes up, as I said, like a passenger, and the excess skin that results from that will be very carefully taken away. And we're not at all relying on the skin to lift the face. And that's what gave us the old-fashioned wind tunnel looks and those very unnatural looks and what are called pixie ears, when the ears got dragged down because the skin just used to want to recoil like a spring and go back to where it originally was.
The results that we're seeing now are just undetectable. They're just so beautiful and fresh. But as you say, it requires a vast amount of skill to do these procedures well. To my mind, if someone's going to invest significantly in their face, it seems silly not to ask you to work on their neck too. For actually, I find many of my female patients these days, the neck is actually their primary concern. Because I think if you don't have those two harmoniously, the face and the neck, it's too obvious maybe that they've had work done on their face. And what are your feelings about this?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And actually, there's a saying amongst face and neck lifting surgeons, a good neck forgives an average face, but the reverse is not true. And by that, what we mean is if the neck is recontoured very well, then actually that has done a great part of the job of rejuvenating that person. Whereas if the face is done well, but nothing is done to the neck, it actually sometimes you can lose the results in the neck, if that makes sense. You don't get such a change because the transition from the face to the neck, not only addressing any sagging and the comments about a turkey neck or a wattle, but actually if you think about our contours in terms of hills and valleys or depressions and areas of greater height, to define a jawline, we need a depression under the jawline, beneath the jawline, that allows the light to fall to define the shadows under the jawline that would allow the jawline to be shown through. So the only way we can often get that is by working on the neck. And doing neck work, we very much recognize that doing things such as trying to remove too much fat under the skin with techniques such as liposuction can actually be absolutely the wrong thing to do, because for a large proportion of people. Structure of the neck is a result of fat, muscle, and actually part of the salivary glands that sit in a deeper part of the neck. So the type of surgery that we need to do in many people to recontour the neck is referred to now as deep neck work, or a deep neck lift with a scar under the chin, which allows us to get to those deeper structures to really recontour the neck, which then allows the rest of the facelift to really show through.
Can you talk us through the process of a facelift from the patient's side? What prep do they ideally need to do? What happens on the day of surgery, including average time scales? And I guess I'm talking the deep plane facelift here. And when can they go home? And what is the recovery like? And the big question, how long before people will see the true results? A lot of questions there.
A lot of questions. If I work backwards, I would suggest to all my patients that they need a minimum of 3, ideally 4 weeks before social engagements, because of course they can go out anytime they want, but if they want to be out there without people really knowing, they need at least that length of time. There's still much more recovery to go after that and residual swelling. And I think really it takes a year before you can assess the final result, particularly if you've done the deep neck work. And that's because a small amount of swelling will always want to sit down under the chin, which is where gravity will dictate it goes. And that really takes that long to settle down.
Yeah.
The deep plane facelift, if we're doing it without the additional neck lift, will take 3 to 4 hours or so. And that can be done as a day case. If I'm doing the neck lift as well, I like to keep my patients in hospital overnight. And that's partly because of the length of surgery, but also because of the safety aspects and their comfort more than anything else. And it does feel in some people really very tight, and in some people that first 24-48 hours is really tough work, really hard, and I don't think we should pretend otherwise. It's not like that for everyone, but I think everyone needs to be prepared that it's not going in for a haircut or a checkup at the dentist. This is big surgery, it's big impact on the body, and they can feel that it takes them a couple of weeks, maybe a bit more afterwards, to really get their energy levels back.
Anything they can do ahead of time to make that easier, other than don't drink a load of booze the night before? I'm guessing, you know, hydrated, all the usual things.
Absolutely. We recommend some nutritional supplements before that can optimize them and their wound healing. We also suggest certain foods to avoid, which can actually, particularly many herbal supplements, which can increase bleeding and bruising. And personally, I don't operate on smokers because nicotine is the single biggest risk factor for wound healing, wound infection problems after surgery. Oh, and the other top tip, and I specifically ask my patients about whether they've got dogs or any pets at home and whether the dogs sleep in their bedroom and particularly on their beds. Because in my experience, the few significant facelift infections I've ever encountered have all been dog related.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So we all know that surgery carries risks, and you've just talked about infection, which is one of the possible risks. Could you go over some of the salient points and what people need to be aware of when they're weighing up the risks and the benefits for them?
That's a great question. And I think in the big picture, we need to think about surgical risk. We need to think about aesthetic risk. You also need to consider financial risk and emotional risk really as well, because all of these things are riding on that operation in different ways for everyone. So from the surgical risk, the 2 or 3 main points that are very specific to facelifting, the one most people are aware of, which is the scary risk, is an injury to a branch of the facial nerve, which can result in an inability to lift an eyebrow or change someone's smile. Fortunately, this is normally a temporary issue that, although it can last several months. And the problem is, for anyone who experiences that, there is no defined end point. It's only time will tell when that kicks back in. And we do know that with more invasive surgery, which is what we've been talking about, the deep neck lifts and the deep plane facelifts, the risk of that happening is higher. And it's a sort of balance of risk reward. So if people don't want to encounter or want to reduce the chance of that risk, they have to compromise on the aesthetic outcome they're going to get. So that is a part of the consultation I always have. The emotional risk, of course, is what do people imagine? Have they thought about how they might feel afterwards and coming to terms with their new face? And hopefully they're not expecting their new face to change their life or their relationships in a way that it can't. And then the financial risk, because we are working with soft tissue. We're not working with two pieces of wood we're screwing together. And there's always a degree of unpredictability about how things might turn out, to a degree that I will do the same operation, or what I feel is the same operation, on two people back to back, but they will have different outcomes. Their results will last a different length of time. And they may have to consider that actually there are adjunctive procedures or further procedures that they might consider to either maintain or enhance their results. And appreciating that there is a cost to these is really important.
Yeah, I mean, how much should people realistically expect to pay? And what are your thoughts on the infamous £250,000 or dollar facelift?
I think it varies, and it varies according to the country you're in. It varies according to the reputation and, dare I say it, social media reputation of the surgeon. I think those with a great social media reputation and following can command six-figure fees, which is extraordinary. But I think in the UK, for an experienced deep plane facelifter and neck lifter surgeon, you're looking around 25,000 to 35,000 for a comprehensive operation. Certainly there are other surgeons who will charge less, and there are different reasons for them charging less, and it could be related to their experience, to their geography in the country, because of course not all parts of the country will have a patient base who might be willing to pay that amount of money. But I think when it gets to those six figures, they tend to be very good surgeons and good colleagues, and I know many of these surgeons, but what they're doing is honestly not much different to what many of us are doing.
Yeah. And if you were to have the neck lift, would that double that average price or add on?
No, I was. The figures I gave were including the neck lift as
Oh, they were. Okay.
Yeah.
Suddenly very reasonable. I'm hooking in, Mark.
Back to the more holistic side of the conversation. I'd also love to know what sort of feedback your patients get from their circles of family and friends, especially if people didn't know they were having a procedure done. Have you got any anecdotal feedback there?
Oh, absolutely. And ironically, the happiest patients, or the ones sometimes with a bit of frustration, are the patients who say no one's noticed. And yeah. I find it extraordinary, because I think if we keep to the rules that someone still looks like themselves and they haven't got a stigmata of having had something done, then it's extraordinary how other people don't notice. And I think a lot of people say their biggest test is when they go to see their mother for the first time. And it's if they can pass the sort of their mother's test, then they know they've got a natural looking result. Yeah. And that's quite interesting. The other, just a slight anecdote, which I think is quite interesting and often not considered, is the husbands and partners, because I will get many women saying that they don't feel their husbands are very supportive of their decision. And I've really, over the years, analysed it and thought about it. And I think it, what many women don't necessarily appreciate is the way the man's mind might work is several fold. It's one, I don't want anything to happen to you and I'm worried about you. You don't need anything done. Mm. Number two, what are you going to look like? And what will my mates say about me if you look a bit weird? And I honestly think there's an underlying concern with men about that. And you will look unnatural. And I had this brilliantly exemplified by a patient who had all of this and concern and lack of support from her husband. And I saw her 2 or 3 months after surgery. And I said, how's it going? How are things with your husband now? And she said, it's amazing. He's fantastic. He's totally behind me. He thinks like amazing. I said, wow, that's very different from when we last spoke. What happened? Do you know why? And she says, I know exactly what happened. She said, I was out at the theatre with my husband and his best friend, who didn't know I'd had anything done a month or so previously, so a couple of months after the facelift. I went off to get some drinks at the bar, and his friend turned around to my husband and said to him, totally unsolicited, your wife looks amazing. She looks fantastic. I haven't seen her looking this good for years. And then just moved the conversation on. And it's almost like our husband needed to hear that to get some objective recognition that yeah. She looked great and she didn't look weird. And even though he'd known what she had done, no one else would know and could tell what she'd had done. I thought that was a great anecdote that explained a lot to me.
Yeah. Or alternatively, maybe some people are afraid that their wife looks so young and gorgeous that will highlight the fact that perhaps they don't, and they'll be booking in as well. Does a facelift do any of the work of fillers or wrinkle relaxers? So does it remove wrinkles, for example? And does it mean that patients can therefore stop having their so-called tweakments? And if not, what is it that people would notice in the mirror in terms of results if it's not taking away wrinkles, if that makes sense?
Oh, absolutely. And so face lifting certainly is not a substitute for wrinkle relaxing injections. And I think that is the single best maintenance procedure someone can continue having afterwards. Mm-hmm. There's always this zone people go through 4 to 6 weeks after surgery when the major swelling settled down, but there's enough swelling that hides the wrinkles. And everyone really loves that point. And then the residual swelling goes down and some of those wrinkles come back again. Mm-hmm. So there are fewer wrinkles for sure, but it's not eradicating wrinkles. Mm-hmm. In terms of filler, it's an interesting question because one of the things in terms of that aged face that looks more squared off compared with the youthful heart-shaped face, one of the principles of a facelift is that it will recontour the face and lift the sagging tissues up to enhance the width of the face and the cheekbones, to the extent that many patients will say in the first couple of weeks that they feel really wide after their facelift. And that's something I warn them about. You will feel like you look wide. You won't, but you'll feel that you do. Mm. And actually the role of fillers to enhance the cheeks and cheekbones, I wouldn't say you'll never need them again, but certainly it won't be needed in the same way afterwards. And actually I'd really take a step back and take a view as to whether they're needed at all.
Interesting. Thank you.
In your opinion, what's the best age to get a facelift? And I think this ties in with also talking about maintenance, because how long does a deep plane facelift last? And I think this question for me, I've had patients along the way who are the same age as me, and at time of recording, I'm 41, who, as their 40th birthday present, flew off to New York to have deep plane facelift done. And that, for me, raises a few question marks, because that patient won't stop caring at 50 or at 60 or possibly even at 70. And how does the maintenance of that tie in?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's interesting. And there's more and more of a discussion, particularly outside the surgical forums, about whether having a preventative facelift is a concept, which I'm not sure it is. There is in any surgery, there's a law of diminishing returns. So there are only so many procedures anyone can have, and each following procedure is going to get more difficult, more challenging, higher risk, more scar tissue. So there's a view one has to take. And whilst I've done some people's third and a couple of people's fourth facelift, there aren't many people like that. And it certainly means we're having to very much adapt and modify what we're doing. So I think a good age, it depends, of course, on the individual, but that perimenopausal age, and that's quite a broad range there, isn't it? It's really from 47 to 55, tends to be a good age for many people to have their first facelift. I have done younger patients, not many, but I have done younger patients. And what is also certainly true is that the younger one is to have the facelift, the more subtle, the less dramatic the change is going to be, which stands to reason. But there is, just going back to the comment I made previously about we're working with soft tissue and not wood or hard material that we can predict with 100% certainty where that future position will be. We have a good idea, but everyone's tissue will behave slightly differently. What that means is any surgery will be several steps forward, but there will be a degree of relaxation, so there's one step back. So by that analogy, an older person may have 10 steps forward and one step back, which means they have a plus nine result. But a younger person may take 3 steps forward and 1 step back, so then they have a gain of 2 in that sort of concept. So mm-hmm. The degree of change is going to be less in a younger person. Therefore, one really has to reflect on the satisfaction one would have with that after undergoing the same procedure.
Okay. But as a rule, would you say if somebody was budgeting and let's say that money was no object, if they had one at, say, 55, would you think it would be reasonable to expect them to come back age 65 and possibly age 75?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly reasonable.
Right, I'm saving up. Would you, or have you, or will you, Mark, have a facelift?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd never say never. I'm 51. It's funny, isn't it? I could certainly see what one would do to my face if I had one, but I don't, from a personal level, I probably need my lower eyelids doing before I have my facelift, actually.
Okay. Same question to you, Sophie.
Oh, I would absolutely have it as and when I need it. I think, as I said, I'm 41 at the time of recording, so at the moment, I think non-surgical treatments are doing a pretty decent job. I'm very well aware that over the next decade, perimenopause will hit. I suspect the first thing that I will probably end up having is an upper blepharoplasty. But as and when I feel that non-surgical treatments are no longer achieving for me what they once did, I would absolutely have a facelift.
So this, I think, brings us on to your general skincare routine, Mark. What sort of products do you use, including any favourite products themselves, brands, ingredients? And more generally, what do you do for your skin, whether that's simple hacks or any non-surgical treatments or so-called tweetments?
Well, the honest answer is probably not enough. I'm very good at advising and telling people what to do and probably don't spend enough care on myself. I do like the Skin Better products that we have at our clinic and I have at home. And I have at different times used some of the Abaji men's products. The challenge with men, and it's total stereotype, isn't it? We need to keep things simple if we're going to actually use them and do them.
Yeah.
And I can vouch for that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Keep it simple. I occasionally use some retinol. I use a moisturizer and some under eye cream.
And that's it. Okay.
I always think a good skincare routine doesn't have to be super complicated. So we're going to move on to our more quick fire round of questions, Mark. Do you take any supplements?
So the quick fire answer is no, I don't.
Oh, not even a vitamin
I probably should.
No. Sophie's going to be sending you loads of stuff in the post. I can feel it. Spamming you. The pair of us, crikey, we'll both spam you with what we take. What about any complementary therapies or wellness protocols or anything sort of biohacky?
Nothing specific, but I'm keeping a very close eye on this emerging field of anti-aging medicine. So there are a variety of supplements and prescribable drugs such as metformin, rapamycin, and these are really interesting. They're being better understood to have a scientifically provable anti-aging property spectrum. I personally would like to see a little bit more in terms of outcomes and trials on them, but these are very interesting areas, which I suspect in the near future will be quite commonly used, actually.
Mm. Yeah, and even down to medications like Ozempic, Wegovy, which have anti-inflammatory properties in microdoses. Mm. I think there'll be a lot more we learn about that. But I think before people jump on bandwagons, we've just got to, as you say, better understand the risk and benefit ratio.
Yeah.
In terms of free time, not that I think you have lots, because I know you also have a family and three children. Tell us about a favourite app, TV show or podcast. What helps you switch off?
So I go for runs and go to the gym, and I do like listening to either current affairs programs or if it's like a geeky amateur historian, I guess. I quite like Trigonometry. It's a good podcast. It's not afraid to challenge the status quo. And I like that they get on guests of different political and other persuasions and really lay into them. And I think it's that sort of thing I find quite interesting because it gets above and beyond the usual, what we're usually fed in by the sort of main media broadcasters.
Yeah, I've not listened to that one, but I've heard very good things as well. Besides family and friends, tell us about a woman that you admire.
Can I keep it professional in terms of, professional as in
Colin?
Yeah. That came out a bit wrong, didn't it? There are two, I think, amazing female plastic surgeons from the States, Caroline Glicksman and Pat McGuire, who have done an incredible amount of work in a different area of plastic surgery, but breast implants. And they've really looked at the science behind what has become a phenomenon and a social media phenomenon of a concept called breast implant illness, which is when there's a group of women who feel their implants are poisoning them. And it's been challenged left, right and center on social media. And these women have pioneered a whole series of studies and really demonstrated that the fears were unfounded. But what really impresses me about them, they are both, particularly Caroline, I think, forces of nature. When you meet them and you hear them talk, and they don't take any prisoners, and they are absolutely, I listen to them talk and I'm totally captivated by them, and they talk so much sense. It's really refreshing.
Tell us about a person that you only met or saw once, but who had a huge impact on you.
I'm going to name someone who I only met once and was someone that really impressed me. So I once met Lord Stuart Rose, who was a past head of Marks & Spencer's in Ocado, at a BARPS-related function. I don't think I've ever been in a room with someone who just had such gravitas and such energy and authority. Just when he was there amongst everyone, but also in his after-dinner speech, that you could have heard a pin drop, and he just held everyone in the palm of his hand. And it was really quite impressive to see someone of that nature and meet someone in person who really was a totally natural leader and just had such authority in a room of people he didn't really know, I think.
It's so inspiring, isn't it, when you see people like that who seem to just naturally imbue that sense of authority and leadership. What would we never guess about you from your CV?
That I am an absolutely skiaholic. I love skiing. I love everything to do with skiing. I love going off piste and doing things that probably I should know better when I depend on my physical well-being for work.
You say that, and I broke my right wrist actually when I was trying to learn to snowboard, and broke it pretty badly back in 2014. And I did go back once afterwards because I was determined not to have a lifelong fear of it. But since then, I've gone, actually, my hands are far too precious for me. But right. I think you kind of almost half grew up on the slopes, didn't you? You skied as a child as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So finally, what's the best advice you've received and given?
Okay. Again, work related, but I remember one of my mentors from when I trained in Australia saying to me that the most important quality in a plastic surgeon is humility. It was absolutely right, because there's no place for arrogance and hubris in what we do. And we're constantly reminded of this with different events that might happen with our patients. And it's an amazingly rewarding career and profession, but it's also a humbling one as well. And that actually is advice I pass on to our trainees, our fellows who come and spend time at the practice. It's never get too big for your boots. Stay humble.
I like that.
Yeah.
So just to finish up, let's tell our listeners a little bit more about you. Like me, Mark is based in Kent, having opened his clinic Purity Bridge in 2013. I was there at the launch. Besides his day job as a surgeon, he regularly trains and lectures both nationally and internationally. While he's experienced in all different kinds of surgery, he specializes in natural looking breast surgery and facial plastic surgery, plus body contouring procedures such as so-called tummy tucks and mummy makeovers. Mark is also often called on to undertake revision breast surgery. So this is to help address issues from past surgery, again, reinforcing just how good he is at what he does. He has an entire page on his website dedicated to his many qualifications, awards, publications and accolades. So you can have a good read there. Go to markpacifico.co.uk, and Mark is spelt with a C. And do also follow Mark on Instagram, where you can see some terrific before and after shots. He's at Mark Pacifico. And again, Mark with the C. Thank you so much for joining us, Mark.
Thank you. It's been great.
And that ends this week's podcast. If you want to find out more about me and my work, or maybe book a consultation, head to drsophieschotter.com, and you can find me on socials at drsophieschotter. And again, thank you so much for listening.